Okay, I'm gonna talk about BC, Benjamin Field, and the title I use is Squeeze and Cut States. I'm gonna talk about two different papers. So this is a work I did with Jacek Ciarmaga, who is a postdoc also in Los Alamos, and Wojciech. That's about cut states and the coherence. And the second one is something I did with Jacek and Roberto Onofrio. It's posted recently in CONMAT, and now we are fighting with the referees and so on, as usual. Well, okay. So, well, as you all know, since 1995 there has been an explosion of experimental and theoretical studies of BECs, and most of the theory has used mean field approximation to explain the experiments, and the theory works pretty well. So, nonlinear excitations can be explained, superfluid dynamics, solitons, vortices, all of those can be explained by the mean field approximation, which is known as, in this context, the Gross-Pitaevsky equation, which is a nonlinear Schrödinger equation. Basically, one assumes that it has n bosons, and the wave function of the n bosons is just a product of identical wave functions for different bosons. So it's a product state. All bosons are in the single particle state, and the equation is something like that. So it's kinetic term, the potential of the trap, and the self-interactions between among bosons. Okay, so I denote this as the first generation of BEC experiments. Recently, there has started what I call a second generation of BEC experiments, whose results cannot be explained by Gross-Pitaevsky equation, so it goes beyond that. And, well, one experiment that I can mention and I will mention later on is one done by Kasevich of Yale, I think, where he obtains number squeeze states of Bose-Einstein condensates. I will go back to that point later on. So, among the many things that has been predicted for BECs are Schrödinger cut states, number squeeze states, and recently there are some proposals to do quantum information about them. So this is what I put here to justify this talk in this audience. But I don't know much about that, to tell you the truth. Okay, so I will start first with the second part of the title, which was cut states. And well, some people here from UNM already heard this part, so I apologize for that. Okay, so the idea is how one can create macroscopic superposition states, okay? So last year, two groups already measured a macroscopic superposition in radio frequency squid. Basically, what they got is a superposition of superconducting currents in a squid going either left or either right. So this kind of superposition. And these states that I measure basically are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian of that system. And those are the references. The cut state contain around 10 to the 9 Cooper pairs. So in BECs, there have been a bunch of theoretical proposals to create macroscopic superposition states. I should say right away that up to now nobody has created such states. Among the proposals are ones that contain superpositions of only atomic cuts. So it's something like that. You have n atoms, n bosons in your trap, and you have two levels that can be either two hyperfine levels, so you have a double wave potential, and the superposition can be either on the right or on the left. So the ideal cut would be all atoms on the left and none on the right, or vice versa. Or all atoms in level A and none in level B, or vice versa. And recently, there is another proposal, which is more far-fetched and possibly and probably more difficult to create than this one, which basically consists of a superposition of atoms and molecules. So there is a process, there are two possible processes in which two atoms can collide and form a molecule. And so they are known as photoassociation, or the other is spectral resonance. And the proposal is, I mean, the cut state in that case is to have all particles in the atomic state and zero molecules, or zero atoms and n dimers, so n atoms together, okay? And they show how to create that. Basically, it's an extension of the ideas here. Okay, and... No. I will tell you how they plan to do, well, what the proposal for the atomic cut states. The other is similar, but I mean, they're very rough ideas, I would say. Okay, here is how to do it and so on. So let's only concentrate on the, well, I have to move this, on the atomic cut. So suppose you have now two levels, two hyperfine internal levels, and denoted by A and B. And so the Hamiltonian of such a system is basically the kinetic part, the self-interaction between particles of level A and the particles of level B. Then there is a density-density interaction between the two levels. This term, if you have a double wave potential, doesn't appear because basically the overlap between the wave functions is very small, so you can forget about that. And then there is a Josephson term that basically couples level A to level B. This is done through a Raman transition. You take particles from one and bring it to the other and vice versa. Okay, this is for atomic cuts. The difference in the atomic molecular is that you have a term which basically you create a molecule and you destroy two atoms, and the other term, okay? So it's a cubic term. That's the process there. But then the rest is more or less the same. So this term in the molecular part will be replaced by such a term. Okay. So the idea is the following. If the difference between these two self-interactions, U and B, is negative, okay, that's the case of attractive interactions. So imagine in the double wave potential, you wouldn't have this term B. So U negative means that the atoms attract among themselves, like in lithium, okay? So if you're under this condition, and also when the number of particles times the self-coupling is much bigger than the Raman part, then what happens is that the ground state of the system contains two superpositions, macroscopic superpositions. So basically you have all atoms in level A and zero in B, and vice versa. And well, it's clear that such a state is not a mean field state. A mean field state would be in a state where each atom is either in A or in B. So it's A dagger plus B dagger to the N, which is obviously not this term. Okay, so just to...
Sorry, I'm confused about that. Can you slide that down again?
Sure. What?
How do the A's and B's relate to the phi's and the gross
equation? Okay, well, yeah, then, okay. So you have a field for bosons in level A, and so this should be a sum over states, and they have operators, A, S, okay? So then what one does is a two-mode approximation. One assumes that in the double well, you only have one level here, so you forget about the sum, you only have one A, and in level B, you have only one level here. And then when one writes the Hamiltonian in terms of the operators, okay, which is an integration over 3D, this energy, this U, this V, and this lambda, basically are integrals over the wave functions. Okay? So it's a... Yeah? Yes?
But are either A or B the condensate field?
Yeah. So it's a condensate mode in condensate field in mode A or condensate field in mode B.
It's something I've never understood. And the first thing you presented where you said they've actually seen a cat shape is in this persistent current
yeah.
case. And what evidence is there that one doesn't have this mean field state where I have a superposition of every electron going left and right in a product state, which is the second thing that you've written down there.
Yeah, this is a discussion that appeared in Ushuaia in a conference. Do you have a good answer for that? Well, what they measure is basically level crossing, energy of level crossing, and from there they infer, but I don't see how you can tell from there if you have a product state or a superposition state.
You already had two informal discussions and many blackboard discussions on this. It's still unresolved.
So?
But I mean, I think most condensed matter physicists believe that it's definitely not of the second type.
Okay. One of the authors of the paper, Moich, is here, I think.
Well,
was here.
He was not here. Yeah.
Okay. So, well. Okay. So, in this case, if you expand the state in terms of Fock states, left or right, okay, so this is sum over L. If L were N over 2, you would have all particles on this side, on the left, let's say, and zero on the right, and vice versa. So this is distribution probability for the amplitudes. In the case where the self-energy, self-interaction is much smaller than the coupling term, the Josephson coupling term, basically you have kind of a Gaussian here. And in the other limit where the on-site energy is much bigger than the coupling, so the system prefers to be localized on either left or right, so you develop two peaks of the probability distribution on L equal minus n over 2 or plus n over 2. So that's the evidence of a catch state. Okay, and now comes the preparation. How do they claim that this could be done? So the idea is that you put all atoms in one of the levels, let's say level A, for the probability distribution is something like that. Then you turn on a pulse in order to create, to make a transfer of atoms from, part of atoms from level A and B in such a way that you have zero phase relation between them. And then you show that in the, with the unitary evolution given by this Hamiltonian, such a state goes after a certain time into a cut state, okay? If you switch off at that time the coupling, the Josephson coupling, you are in a cut state, but if you don't, I mean, this goes back again into this one.
So basically, because it's sort of like a perturbed, it's like a harmonic oscillator with a quartic perturbation.
Exactly.
Doing this.
Exactly. But I mean, I don't know if it's a good idea to do this, because if you miss the time when you switch off, you are somewhere else. So it's not very robust.
Cats are not very robust.
So you said before, this is the ground state. The ground state of this system is a cat state, right?
Yeah.
So why is it easier to start with all the atoms in state A than to just start in the ground state?
Well, to start in ground state, you have to cool it a lot.
Well, all the atoms being in state A is a very, very low entropy state as well.
Yeah, but I think you can choose a trap, you know, only to trap certain kind of states and not the others. Is it true?
You can create condensate in two states, but the difficulty is the separation between the even and odd cat states is exponentially smaller than the number of particles. So it's basically, I don't know if anybody knows how to cool really down to the very ground state of the coupled system. Maybe for low enough atomic numbers, if it's less than 100 or so, it might be.
Maybe. Well, but the idea here is to make something macroscopic, so I don't know.
But it is easy to get all the atoms in state A.
Yes,
yeah.
That's
what people do usually. Okay, so what we did is to study, how long, to make estimations of how long such a cat state can live. So we study the coherence, and the source of the coherence we studied turns out to be the most important source, and it's the thermal cloud of atoms that are in the trap that can be small, but even then can still destroy the coherent superposition. So we'll not go into the details of the calculation, it's kind of boring. But basically, we obtain a lower estimate for the coherence rate, which is here. And well, the first coefficient took 9 pages of a paper, and the other two parts is pretty easy to what it is. Basically, you have a the coherence here is due to collisions between condensed atoms in the VC and non-condensed atoms outside. So the ray has to be proportional to the cross section. Okay, the density of non-condensed particles, the thermal velocity of non-condensed particles, and it also is proportional to n squared, where n is the number of particles in the condensate. Basically, this is the distance squared between the elements of the superposition. This is kind of general result, but I mean, to calculate this, there are lots of approximations. Basically, we are using Born approximation and Markov approximation, which are justified more or less. So for typical values of an experiment, well, this is for rubidium. This is what's called the scattering length. The decoherence time is 10 to the 5 seconds divided by the number of atoms in the non-condensate and the square of the number of atoms in the condensate. And I think now I put the numbers correctly. For example, just to make a simple example, if you have 10 to the 5 atoms in the condensate and 100 atoms in the non-condensate, the coherence time turns out to be 10 to the minus 7 seconds, and it's kind of small. So we wanted to see how can we improve this, prevent the coherence.
So you skipped over that expression, the part that you said took you the long time, right? That's the 16 pi squared?
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously...
And there are lots of approximations there. So.
Right. I'm not going to understand why it's exactly 16 pi squared.
Neither do I.
The reason that it's of order, I mean, that's about 100. Why is it that instead of 10 to the minus 12 or 10 to the 30th? What sort of numbers go into calculating that?
Well, basically, you are making some assumptions of the profile of the wave functions that you have there, the frequency of the trap, scattering lengths, and all that.
Okay. So it's not terribly physically relevant. It's just a bunch of details.
Yeah.
Order but, one.
Yeah, well, but
I guess I was asking why.
It's really funny because we wrote down, you know, the substantial part of the formula after talking for about 10 minutes on the board, right? And then the derivation took like a couple of months, and, you know, it didn't change much. So.
Okay, so the idea was to see what can we do to improve the coherence rates. I mean, make them smaller, or the coherence time make them larger. And this kind of a movie of what we propose. Basically, what we propose is the following. So you have one thing I should say is that all these steps, in principle, have already been done experimentally. What has not been done is create the cut state, but this can be done and has been done, basically by the MIT group. So you have the trap, which is usually a harmonic trap with the levels, single particle levels. First step is to put here a laser, an optical trap, so that you produce a dip there. And you can choose the parameters so that you have only a single level there, and that's where you will create the cut. So you trap it there. And then, so the atoms in the condensate will interact with this guy, and this will produce the coherence. The fact that you have a gap here reduces the coherence rates already. Then you turn off the magnetic trap so that lots of atoms here fly away. So you reduce this number. But still, there can be left some atoms there. And then here is the second part of the engineering proposal, let's say, which is what we call symmetrization of the environment. And it's also pretty easy what it is. So the environment is a sum of the different levels of for states of environment A and B of the kinetic term plus the coupling term. Since the environment is very dilute, we are assuming that we can neglect the self-interactions here. That's one point. So basically, if you have this and you introduce symmetric operators symmetric under the interchange between A and B and anti-symmetric. Clearly, this Hamiltonian basically has two parts, one that involves only symmetric and asymmetric, and the energy levels are shifted, one downwards, this one, and the other upwards. This is what you have in when you have a magnetic field coupled to a spin. Okay, and the splitting here is twice this coupling. So if you could, in principle, cool down the system so that the temperature is lower than this gap, basically will occupy only these states, the symmetric states. And in such a case, when a symmetric particle collides onto a condensate, since the cut is symmetric under the interchange, such a process will not destroy the coherence of the cut. Will only produce a global phase, but not destroy the coherence. So if you could go into this limit, the coherence would be zero. But obviously, you cannot go there. Oh, okay. I mean, if you could go there, then you would have a two-dimensional space spanned by these two states, which would be a decoherence-free subspace or this coherence-free pointer subspace, which is what he likes to call it. Okay. If not, so if temperature is higher than this, so that you have also occupied anti-symmetric states, the collision of these guys with the condensate here will produce a coherence. So we came back to our calculations, it's 9 pages, blah, blah, blah. And you can also, again, it's the same basically for the coherence rate, is exactly the same as before, but now the number of non-condensed atoms has to be replaced with the number of non-condensed atoms in the anti-symmetric state. Okay? So here, and so this is a sequence of ideas to do it. As I told you, I mean, this is only ideas, but I don't know how, if Ketterle or Cornell really take this seriously. Once we were talking, I think, with Cornell in the Sush, and I asked him when he was going to give the, I mean, try to measure this, or produce a cut say. I don't think it was he or someone else, a student of him, and he said that after the Nobel Prize. So perhaps in some years they will do it.
You should have gotten it in writing.
I think it was a student of him, not him, but one. Anyway. Okay, and there are many other possible sources of coherence here. I only put three. And in our paper we have give some estimations, calculate some estimations of these different processes, and it turns out that they are less important than the thermal cloud. I will not talk about them. We can talk about later. Okay, it's half the time. So now I'm gonna switch gears and talk about the other part of the title of the talk is squeeze states in DCs. Yeah.
Just a quick question before we move on from that. When you apply this anti, is breaking the symmetry between symmetric and anti-symmetric states.
There's a better way to say that.
What effect does that have on your condensate? Your condensate's in a cat state, which is either symmetric or anti-symmetric, right? And
well, what happens if when you turn this lambda thing? I mean, if you lambda is zero, the states n0 and 0n are degenerate.
Right.
When you turn it on, you are opening a little bit gap, which is exponentially small with the number of particles.
So lambda induces a big energy difference for the thermal cloud, but only a very small energy difference?
Yeah, because I mean one is more diluted than the other. That's the expectation.
Okay.
And also ask a question on this part before you move
on. Yeah.
You know, there was an experiment that was done by Cornell and that group at Killa where they had two component condensates made by making Raman Pyron 2 pulses at superpositions of individual atoms with different internal states. And I guess there was some discussion at that time as to whether or not what they were seeing was in fact, a mean field kind of state or a cat state and so forth. And of course, in that, if I understand it correctly, in that experiment, what they were doing was not the limit that you're looking at. In other words, the Raman coupling was very strong compared to the, because they put on a very strong Pyron 2 pulse compared to the mean field.
Okay.
And so the question I have is, you know, why can't they just make their state? You know, what's the hard thing to do? It seems to me, as long as one turns down the Raman coupling so that the mean field energies are sufficiently big, one should naturally evolve into these cat states. What limits? Is it the preparation? Is it the decoherence along the way? Do you have a sense of that? I mean, why couldn't they?
So you said that they had a big transitional coupling there?
A big Raman coupling.
Okay. But in that case, the ground state is a coherent state. You can show that it's not a...
Right. So, you know, instead, turn down their Raman coupling. I mean, what's hard, I think, in the Serac Zoller is actually what Raman said. The hard thing is that you have to prepare all the atoms on the left side of the well exactly.
Yeah, well, I think that's another difficult part, because that's what people do. I mean, well, this group, I mean, in the experiment, probably they started with all atoms in one hyperfine level, and then they switch on.
Yeah, I mean,
so they did all that already.
That's a different, they're the modes, the two states are different internal states.
Yeah, but here, I mean, this is also the same. This is valid for internal states or for that well. I mean,
sure. It's just the question of the initial preparation.
Yeah, I don't think it's that.
It's the question of interspecies interactions.
Yeah.
I guess I missed the first part of the talk, but you either need attractive interactions between atoms, or if you have repulsive interactions, for this to happen,
you might not be
the repulsive interaction between two different states has to be stronger than the repulsive interaction in between the atoms in the same state. And that's very difficult to get.
I think it's
exactly the geometric average. So S-ray scattering length is right in between.
Right. Okay.
There's also another point that, I mean, I assume that in all these models, Serac Zoller and so on, you assume that everything is perfectly symmetric. So the U, the self-interaction between A's and between B's is exactly the same, and so on. But which is not true in general. So in general, I mean, the different species have either different scattering lengths, or they have different magnetic moments. So if there's a magnetic field, the magnetic field can tell whether you're in one or the other. So those are also two things that are causes of the coherence. Okay, so the next part is, Squid says, I never given this talk, so this is going to be completely new. And if someone here is a referee, please stand up. So, okay. So now we are going to consider the opposite case where U minus V is positive. So it's a case of repulsive interactions. Or, as he was saying, the interactions between different is bigger than the cell, the mutual interaction. Okay, so again, here one can go into the two limits where the energy on site is less or bigger than the Raman coupling. In the case where it's less, one can show that, in fact, the ground state is a mean field state, is a coherent superposition. The mean number of atoms in level A is equal to the mean number of atoms in level B, is equal to the half populations. And the dispersion in the number of particles per site goes like the square root of the number of particles. So one has Poissonian distribution there. In the opposite case, when one has on-site energy much bigger than the Raman coupling, what happens is that the system prefers to be here or here, okay, in other side. And the ground state in that case is basically a product state, it's a Fock state of NA particles in site A and NB particles in site B. And the sum of the two has to be equal to the total number, obviously. Okay, and the fluctuations are equal to zero. In the intermediate cases, this is not PowerPoint, that one. The fluctuations in the number of particles per site as a function of the on-site energy divided by the hopping part, okay, decreases in the following way. So for when this is zero, you have coherent states. This goes like square root of n, Poisson distribution. Then it goes down in what is called squeeze states, because the distribution, this guy scales as n to a power which is less than 1/2. So sub-Poissonian distribution, and then it goes to zero when the on-site energy is much bigger than the hopping part. And, well, this is related to the mode insulator phase transition. I will talk about that in a minute. So this is my transparency of an experiment done by Kasarich. And there is a part that I don't understand, so perhaps we can all understand it together. So what they have there is an optical trap, and then they switch an optical lattice. This is in 1D, so it's two counterpropagating beams, which are off resonance. So the resonant transition between the two internal levels of rubidium-87 that they use is at 780 nanometers, and the standing wave has a wavelength of 840. They have around 10 to 3 atoms, and they can produce more or less around 12 wells. I mean, 12 wells are effectively occupied. And you have your VC sitting part in one well, and so on. And by controlling the intensity of this laser, they can modify the height of the barrier. Okay? Good. So if this barrier were low, one is in the regime where you are in the coherent state. So the dispersion number of atoms scales like the square root of the total number of particles. If this is very big, the VC tries to be localizing in different wells, so you are more into a Fock state case. And in the middle, you are in the squeeze regime. And in the experiment, they are in this regime. They go from coherent states to squeeze regime. They couldn't get into the Fock regime, but it seems that there are some rumors and some people have done it already. Okay. So how is it that they measure this quantum state of the system? Okay, and this is a part which I don't understand completely. Let's see. So what they do is they prepare an initial state, which is a coherent state with a big trap. Then they turn the other on. They modify for different values of U0. Okay. Then they switch everything off. They let it release under gravity. The different clouds, overlap, interfere, and through absorption imaging, they measure the density profile of what they get at the end. Okay, so these are the density profiles as a function of a vertical position. Okay. Okay, the values of the on-site energy divided by the hopping are this. Okay. 3, 10 to the 2, 10 to the 5. So this is increasing on-site energy. So in this direction, one expects to go more into the Fock state regime, more squeezing here. As you increase U0, you should also have more squeezing. And clearly the difference is that in this case, you have two peaks, and as you increase, you go more into the squeezing part, you only have one peak. Okay, what they say is this is an evidence that you are here in a quasi-coherent state, and here you are in a more squeezed state. And now comes what I don't understand. They say the following. If you are in a coherent state and you release the atoms, when they interfere, you should have an interference pattern. Okay. Whereas if you are more in the Fock state, of 12 volts in Fock state, and they release, the interference pattern should be completely washed out. But they also, note there that the interference pattern of two Fock states is the same as the interference pattern of two coherent states with random relative phase. So I don't see why if you go from 2 to 12, should be a difference. Okay.
Each pair will have a different and random phase. So even though in principle, two pairs, one pair is identical to coherent state.
When you come along two?
Many pairs, then they have all basically they develop random relative phase, and therefore you don't see any. Coherent state, there is a fixed relative phase between all different elements.
So as increase the number of wells, I mean the even worse. So what I do from here? They measure the variance of the phase of the state, and from there the inverse is the variance of more or less the variance of the.
Because they obtained after letting the condensate
fall. Yeah.
Why are there only two?
What they say there is that, well, I don't understand it, but they say that because of the experimental setup, there is some kind of a localization on the other two peaks, but I don't see why. I mean, in principle, I would expect the world 12, but.
What's the scale?
Yeah, 50 microns. 50
microns,
yeah. Okay. So I have a paper here, we can read it, but I don't get it.
The wavelength of the standing wave is about 1 micron. So I think what you're seeing there is each of those bumps represents the entire, there's no correlation between those bumps and the wells in the standing wave. Each of those bumps represents essentially the whole
guy.
And if you looked at each of those wells, I mean, if you could resolve each of those bumps very, very finely, you would see a modulation on a 1 micron scale due to the initial standing wave. What you're seeing there, I believe, and I could be totally wrong about this, is that when the trap is turned off, that if you're in the GP equation, what you have is essentially a standing wave sort of state. And that decomposes into a traveling wave, and it's modulated by Gaussian.
So one's going left and right.
Into a traveling wave going what route and right. And you can actually see in the type binding.
So basically, they go like that.
Right.
It's just a Fourier transform.
It's a spectrometer, right? I mean, you have 12 slits, right? And because you have 12 slits instead of two, then you have left or right versus. Right.
Yeah. And actually, if the potential is turned up, but you stay in the GP regime, you'll see more bumps, I believe, because in addition to the left moving and right moving waves, there's a double speed left moving and a double speed right moving, but those are very, very weak in this case.
Okay. Good. And this is another graph from their paper, which is basically the squeezing factor as a function of the on-site energy versus the hopping. And squeezing is defined as squeezing in the phase, like that. And the different points are for different initial densities of the condensate, with a modifier according to the frequency of the trap. And as you see here, the squeezing scales like the square root of the on-site energy versus the hopping, and we're going to do something similar in a minute. I'm sure that this is also the case for our model. The mode transition, so the transition that you go from quasi-coherent into fog states, happens when this ratio is of order n squared, which in their case would be 10 to the 6. They are one order of magnitude below that, so they never get into the fog regime. But I think you told that there are some group.
I'm confused. I thought that the mod insulator transition was required to have traffic.
No.
This you say happens in 1D.
I think that this paper of Sirac that you were showing me the other day also is in 1D, isn't it? It's in 2D, the paper.
In 3D.
I think it's in 2D.
Yeah. But I'm not sure.
Well, you see, I think to get really unit occupancy of each site, you would probably need a big beach trap. And I think that's what is done in
that hedge groups experiment. That's my understanding as well. You're saying just a transition where you'll see perfect number squeezing, an integer number,
Yeah.
That still could happen in one day.
Okay. Okay. So, what we studied is something which it's gonna be gonna turn out to be related to this, and it's the measurement back action in VC. So, how does the measurement, the imaging of a VC affects its dynamics? And we'll see that by measuring it in certain configuration, one can drive the system into a squeeze state also, and the equations are pretty similar. Okay. Okay, so here's kind of a small review of how VCs are measured. So there are two optical techniques. One is absorption imaging. So the previous transparency with all this interference pattern was done with this technique. And basically, one sends a light beam which is in resonance with the condensate. It gets absorbed, and one sees a shadow. Okay. And which is proportional to the line integration of the density of the condensate. This kind of measurement is, since it's on resonance, it heats up the condensate, so it destroys the condensate. So after one shot, the condensate is no longer there, and you have to do the experiment again to do something else. Okay, and the other one, which is the one that we are going to study, is what's called phase contrast imaging, which is, another difference is that one sends an off-resonant beam, so there's no absorption, no heating. What happens is that the condensate acts as a dielectric media, so it changes the refraction index there, and produces a phase shift, okay? And then by doing an interference experiment, one can see, translate the phase shift into intensity, and that's proportional again to the density. This is what is used in biology for seeing living cells which are otherwise transparent. Okay, so in this way one can have multiple images of the same condensate at a time, and if one could do this in a continuous way, one would have a movie of a condensate in the trap. So what we want to do is to focus on the dynamics on the condensate, and so the light field will be an environment for that condensate. So now we apply all the standard techniques of decoherence and all that. So what we do is measure the environment, measure the light field, and from that measurement we get information about the state of the condensate. Okay? And so again, to study the dynamics of a condensate, we trace over all the environment, so we find the master equation for the condensate. Approximations used here are again Born and Markov, and they are justified here also. And we have in the paper we have derived the continuous master equation, okay, which is kind of complicated. I will talk just on a little toy model, which is what happens if you have a two-dimensional optical lattice with the condensate there, and you send the light beam to do phase contrast imaging. So the master equation for such a case has two parts. Well, one part, which is the usual one, that is basically the Hamiltonian part, has a hopping part between nearest neighbors, K and L, the potential part, and then one has a second part, which is of a Lindblad form. So it's a commutator of the number of particles per site, commutator, and S is a measurement strength, okay? Well, all this follows from integrating, tracing over all the environment. And this measurement strength is...
I'm a bit confused here because in phase contrast imaging, you're assuming that there is no spontaneous emission. And then the laser is a coherent source. So, which you treat classically. How do you get that term? The light field you use.
Yeah, we consider it's
a coherent.
Oh, we assume it's, in the calculation, we assume it's a plane wave.
A classical source.
Basically, we don't assume anything else, yeah.
So you have a
So the interaction between the two things is the density of a condensate times E squared intensity of the light.
So we plug it. You must get entangled, right? If you're ending up getting.
Yeah.
So you must treat the field quantum
mechanically. Mechanically then. Or how
otherwise, yeah. You don't get entanglement.
But the only thing we use about the field is that it's in, well, initially it's in vacuum. Well, no, no, sorry. Initially it's just a plane wave with a given intensity. That's the only things we use.
But you don't treat it as a classical.
No.
A quantum field in a coherent state.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay, so that measurement strength turns out to be proportional to the intensity. I mean, it has information about the quantum state of the light field. And so it depends on the intensity, on the momentum, on the K0, okay? And on the electric susceptibility, which enters into the coupling between the light field and the DC. Okay. So we're going to study this equation. And so there are two competing factors. One is the hopping part, okay, which tries to send one particle to the neighbors. So it's something that tries to delocalize the things. And then there is localization due to the measurement. I mean, the measurement tries to measure the particles on each well, so we will try to, I mean, project this quantum state onto Fock states on each well. So if one only has this term, and forget about this, pointer states, I mean, of such a guy, are Fock states. But since you have a self-Hamiltonian, there will be a competition between the two. And when, so it's pretty obvious what will happen. I mean, it turns out that the pointer state, let's say, of the whole thing will be in between coherent states, which are completely localized, or Fock states, so it will be squeezed states. And that's what we get. Okay. So now we wanted to solve this equation. So we did that numerically. But before that, so in order to do that, we make an unraveling of the master equation in terms of quantum trajectories, which can be interpreted as what you get in a single realization of a given experiment. So basically, one introduces a pure step psi, and the average of that, of the associated density matrix with respect to all possible stochastic realizations of experiment, gives you the master equation there. So this guy can be written in the Fock basis of the different sites on the lattice with a given amplitude, and this is the sum of all possible configurations. And the master, and the stochastic Schrödinger equation basically has a hopping part, I don't know by this H, a potential part, and then something that comes from the measurement part. So it's something that tries to localize a number of particles. This is basically the dispersion, and then here is the noise part. Okay, so this is written in the Stratonovich version, it's not detailed. And the noise has an average of realizations equal to zero, and it's a white noise with a strength given by S. So it's a delta of time and a delta in position. Okay, and the point is you want to solve this equation. If you solve that equation, and then you can calculate this guy an average, you could also calculate the density matrix as how it evolves in time. Okay, so, well, if you don't have hopping, one can find an exact solution. And the solution for the amplitudes are basically Gaussians, the product of different Gaussians on different sides, and it has two parameters. One is the number of particles per side, and the other is the dispersion, and the equations for those two guys are something like this. So the dispersion decreases in time, so if you solve this equation, the asymptotic value is dispersion equal to zero, so you are completely in a Fock state, and that's consistent with the fact that you only have measurement and no hopping, so you should drive into a Fock state. And so this is a plot of dispersion or a number of particles in a given site as a function of time. And if you start initially in a coherent state, the measurement will try to localize it in Fock states. Well, this is for a 1D model of three modes. Okay. As you turn off the hopping, so you increase the frequencies, the dispersion, the asymptotic dispersion starts to grow, and the more hopping you are, the more dispersion you are, so you are more squeezed. Okay? Good. And the second graphic is the dispersion, the asymptotic dispersion, infinity, as a function of this ratio, hopping initial density of particles per site over the measurement strength, square root. And so again, it's a linear dependency. So you can think of this as if S, you replace it by G, so the on-site energy coupling, this is analogous of what you get in Kasevich experiment. But instead of driving the going, I mean, instead of going into a squeezing state through changing the potential, you're increasing the measurement, which also tries to localize. Difference here, this is non-unitary, because we have traced over the environment, where the other is a unitary evolution. And so here at the end, there are some estimations of what would happen if, with Kasevich experiment, you also do phase contrast imaging on top of his experiment. So these are the parameters of his experiment. And if you use an intensity for the phase contrast imaging laser of 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, one can get an squeezing factor of roughly 50. So, okay, so you go into the squeezing thing. You follow me or no? Because there are no questions now, so I... Okay, so it's 1 hour, I'm ending here. So conclusions. Well, basically it's what I said already, but... So experiments are already probing BC physics beyond mean field, and well, Kasevich experiment is one of them, and Hensch will be another one. Another nice thing about BC, as opposed to superfluid, is that you can study the quantum dynamics with a theory of first principle, which is not phenomenological. So macroscopic superposition states have been predicted for BC. They have not been created, and I don't know if there will be. But we'll have studied decoherence and how to prevent it by trap and environmental engineering. So squeezed states have been produced, and they could be used for atom interferometry and quantum phase transitions. And what we have shown here is that if you measure the BC, the measurement can affect, can back act and affect the dynamics of BC and drive it into squeezed states. That's it. Thanks.
Discussion of this back action in your analysis of it. You have an ensemble of atoms, and the how are you describing the state? Your density operator is a density operator for the many body state?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
And
so the state side of the right has n particles.
And a definite number thereof.
Yeah.
It's a nice idea. In fact, there was an equivalent experiment that's been done, which you may or may not be aware of, by Nick Bigelow's group, where they saw spin squeezing do the back action from a continuum. So you have a probe, electromagnetic field that goes through a cold gas of atoms, and they measure the Faraday rotation. And the Faraday rotation of the polarization tells us something about the internal states and their getting spin squeezing. So it's such an experiment as like that.
I didn't know that.
Been done before.
You have the reference?
Yeah,
sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So I'm curious about when you you treat the interaction of the light with the condensate. Basically, the treatment of the light coming in is that it's a coherent.
Well, it's a plane wave with a gate, yeah.
It can't be a single photon. You're not looking at a single particle here. And it's a plane wave, so it's got to be quantum. It can't be classical, otherwise you wouldn't have it be coherent. So the only thing that's left that I can see is some sort of coherent state of the field.
Okay.
So maybe I'm wrong about that, but I'm assuming that's what it is. And then because you're off resonant, there's no absorption or emission with the condensate. So the interaction should be essentially linear and classical as well. So what it seems is that you're doing, if I understand this right, you're doing quantum mechanical treatment, but all of the interactions, all of the states Hamiltonian interactions involving the light are essentially classical. There's nothing non-linear. So semi-classical dynamics should treat the light exactly. Is that right? In the sense that whenever you have interaction of coherent states that only interact through linear Hamiltonians, that's semi-classically exact. Am I misunderstanding something?
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is that you would assume that the states would stay separable. So if you have atomic state times coherent state, then
absolutely not. You definitely get decoherence. You definitely get entanglement. But if it's a completely separate issue to talk about whether there's entanglement and whether a semi-classical treatment is exact.
You're talking about that the whole thing would still be a Gaussian state?
Basically, yes.
But it would be...
It's cheaper enough.
Right. Yeah. How could I talk about it that way? It's the only way to say that if it's separate. How do I say something's in a Gaussian state when it's split?
It's in a Gaussian state.
I'm working on this problem right now. It's you can very easily have completely Gaussian states that are not at all separable. Anyway, if that's true, I'm just curious what might happen differently if you used quantum light, essentially. If you sent in light, so the interaction is classical because it's off resonance. What if you were to send in light that was not in a classical state?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Who's Chris?
I came in late, so maybe this question was addressed, so I apologize if that's the case. In preparing your cat, you're trying to take some state which looks like a Gaussian or something like that, and then write it as a superposition of two well-separated such things. And the decoherence is because the thermal atoms
can tell.
Scatter off of one or the other, and then they know where it is. Is that basically right? So if you had such a thing, presumably these distributions have tails. So if you had them relatively close together so their tails overlap, the states wouldn't be exactly orthogonal.
Yeah.
But presumably this would reduce the rate of decoherence. Do you know how, as a function of how much they overlap, the decoherence time changes?
No, because...
Superposition doesn't overlap, which means, because it's the size of your diagonal elements, right? So.
Right.
So by the time they don't overlap much, you don't gain much.
Okay.
So the back action of this on the light field would be some sort of...
Oh, the other way around, okay.
I mean, that...
localization of light?
This is a nonlinear medium, so from the optics perspective, and it's known that when you have nonlinear entries, you can create squeezing. But it seems to me that what is different here is that you have this matter which is coherent form, which may not be coherent, but it's in these sort of pockets, and the interaction, the part of the light field that interacts with these pockets will, the relative fluctuations might become different. I don't know if that's
interesting.
But you'd
have to do the measurement on the atoms.
On the atoms. But how you measure the atoms?
make a measurement on atoms and see if that would affect the interference of the light here.
But how do you measure the atoms? I mean, if you know what this light field.
You do a
distance. Oh, and now a second one.
Yeah. Turn away then.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. So,